welcome to 45 North. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and I am delighted to welcome two gifted storytellers to the radio stage today. Dean Bacopoulos and Katie Burns are with us to share some of their new story log. Katie is a singer-songwriter from Mineral Point, Wisconsin. She's got a new CD out called You'll Find Your Way. Dean is an award-winning novelist who used to live in Wisconsin before he ditched us to teach creative writing at Grinnell College in Iowa. He's written two critically acclaimed novels, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon and My American Unhappiness. Dean and Katie, welcome. It is so glad to have you. So good to have you guys here today. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having
us.
And
thanks to our tiny studio audience, people who have braved the unseasonable cold and rain. So here, clap for ourselves. Yay. Dean, first of all, I love the word, but what is a story log?
Well, it's a kind of a play on monologue, of course, or dialogue, which is a conversation. In this case, it's a conversation in stories. So Katie and I both storytell in different ways, and we kind of obsess and talk about these stories. So in some ways, this is a conversation on the themes we write about, or I write about, and she writes about. So it's, a conversation through stories is what it's like.
Katie, which comes first, the words or the music?
Sometimes both, I guess. They come at the same time a lot. But sometimes if I read something that Dean has written, it'll just trigger a whole song, you know, just one line.
Uh-huh. So. Well, I don't know whether to call this a new kind of storytelling or something very old. It sort of goes back to the roots of storytelling.
Yeah, I guess it's both. I mean, I think definitely the roots of storytelling are, of course, oral and a crowd gathered around to listen to the storyteller. And that's kind of what we're trying to recreate. We've been going around Wisconsin at book festivals and other venues trying these out. So this is kind of a new venture for both of us. But the crowd always, I think, has no idea what to expect. And then afterwards, it's a good sign because they hang around and ask a lot of questions and want to know where we're playing next. So it seems to be catching on.
Mm-hmm. And was there any particular inspiration for doing this?
Katie might have a different inspiration. I think part of it was just having young children who were playing together. Our families are good friends. And when you're artists with young children in a minimal amount of time, sometimes you come up with ideas among diaper changes and screaming kids and temper tantrums. And it's kind of where this started. It was our kids were playing and we were talking.
Wow. I wish such creative things came back from my days of diaper changing. Well, so one of the things that you do is all of these are stories about kind of small town Wisconsin, right? And you guys met when you were both living in a small Wisconsin town, Mineral Point. So the fictional town you've created, is it pretty much based on Mineral Point, or is this a kind of, I don't know, your version of Lake Wobegon?
Sort of. It's Lead Corners, and it's fictional. It's Mineral Point and Spring Green merged together. Those are the places I spent most of my time when I was living in southwest Wisconsin. So I pushed those together.
And what is it that makes small towns such a great focus for stories?
Well, sometimes, you know, with Mineral Point, I was the only one of the only writers in town. And so people just found you and told you things that maybe they wouldn't tell anybody. The writer becomes this sort of repository for people's deepest secrets. So
I had no idea what would people meet you like. You'd be sitting having coffee in the local diner and somebody would come up and just tell you about their intimate lives.
It was less coffee than beer at the tavern. I think it was coffee doesn't loosen the tongue quite as much as a couple pints. So I think it was a lot of times late at night when there was no one else to talk to, and I was watching a game or something at Tony's Tap or the Midway. Somebody might start telling me something.
Well, so small towns, I think, are in America, like the small American town. It's such an iconic place. It's a mythic place when you think about it. Simple on the surface, maybe. But it sounds like complex underneath.
And Katie still lives in Mineral Point.
I still live in Mineral Point.
So we have to be careful.
So you have to be careful what you say. Yeah. Is it very complex underneath?
I think it is. Yeah, I really like it, though. I mean, yeah, I like small town.
What do you like about them?
I like that you can walk everywhere. And that the people, they almost seem like you're related to them because you see them constantly, you know. So it's like a family a little bit.
Which, that sounds horrifying.
Well, I know it is kind of, but at the same time with your kids, you feel, it feels good. When I don't know if I would have liked it if I didn't have three kids, you know, everybody's helping me take care of them. So
when there's a mineral pointer watching her three kids right now for
right,
us.
So. One of my friends.
There you go. Well, and in some ways, people who live in bigger cities, what do? We just create small towns within our big cities. I mean, what you're talking about sounds like my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dean, what interests you about small towns as a writer?
I think there's something to be said for the intensity of experience that one has when the routine is pretty much the par for the course. You go to the coffee shop, you know everybody. You know everyone downtown at the tavern. You know your route you walk is pretty much the same, and you pass the same people every morning. So when characters or people are in a routine and something shakes them up, a stranger comes to town, somebody acts on impulse and out of character, the drama is just incredibly intense because you can't do those things. A stranger can show up in New York City and no one ever know. Someone could act on impulse, you know, in Chicago and nobody would know about it. But if you do something in a small town or if you show up, by morning everyone's talking about it. And that drama, you know, it breeds other drama.
That sounds like a perfect segue into your story log. Can we hear a story?
Sure. We can do that. So in Lead Corners, as I was saying, there's a lot of people who want to talk to the writer. And this is a story I heard a little while ago about a guy named Blizzard. Blizzard, his wife had left him suddenly with two small children in a small town. And he told me that the thing that was the most terrifying about that was the look of self-pity or the look of pity that people would give him because everybody knew what he was going through. And his sister, who is a well-meaning woman, her name was Annie, would always tell him to take alone time. And the alone time was something that he ended up having to take at the only place in town you could really go have alone time, which was the Opera House on High Street where they showed movies on Monday nights. And so there's Blizzard having his alone time sort of mandated by his family and friends. And we pick it up in July. It's a hot evening, and the air conditioner in the old opera house had drawn a decent crowd, which meant about a dozen people in Lead Corners, though nobody ventured into the balcony where the seats were less comfortable and the air less cool. Nobody, that is, except for a young woman who seemed to appear from nowhere. She'd come silently up the carpeted steps, and when she saw Blizzard, she seemed almost surprised to see him sitting there. She'd come in with a huge tub of popcorn and a large Pepsi, and she sat three rows ahead of him, just to his right. He studied her profile. He admired, with some anguish, her jawline and the long, thin curve of her neck. The sneak previews began, and Blizzard realized he'd not even looked at the marquee to see what was playing. Not that it mattered, the theater had only one screen, but still, he liked to know what he was signing up for what he'd be doing to kill this alone time everybody so vehemently suggested he needed. The opening credits came on, the music, the opening shot, a pastoral vista near the ocean. They were all pleasant enough, and Blizzard took them in, but continued mainly to watch the only other moviegoer in the balcony. She was eating the heck out of that popcorn. Meanwhile, in the movie on the screen, a couple was driving to a wedding somewhere on the California coast, the man irritated and dashing, the woman near tears. Blizzard could already tell. Not his cup of tea. He looked again at the woman three rows ahead of him, and even in the dark, the vague idea that he had recognized her from the theater solidified in his head. She was an actress from New York, and Blizzard knew she was about to open up a run of Hamlet. She would play Ophelia. He knew this because he worked maintenance at the theater, and he watched some of the rehearsals on his breaks, perched high in the theater's back row, sipping black coffee from a metal thermos. She turned to him suddenly, as if aware of his staring, and made eye contact. He flipped his gaze back to the screen. Her name, the popcorn eater's, was Angela Zell, and because he had seen her before, he knew she had blonde hair, which she wore most often pulled back in a simple ponytail. She had pale blue eyes that were almost eerie, he told me later, and once in a while, it was as if she were moments away from running a few small errands and then hurling herself madly into a swamp. He looked at her again. She had turned around now and had noticed him and was waving. She stood up. He smiled. What else could he do? Soon she was flopped down next to him, spilling a few kernels from the enormous tub of popcorn she held in her hand. "It's frickin' freezing in here," she said. "Do you want some popcorn?" She held the tub so it was halfway over his lap. "Okay," he said. She nudged him a bit with her elbow, a gentle ribbing, smiling at him and turning back to the screen as if they just shared a private joke. He had no idea, of course, what that joke was, but he smiled back and felt a tingling in the lobes of his ears. And that's how they finished the movie, sharing the popcorn, holding it between them, like that. At the end of the movie, he thanked her for the popcorn, said he had to go relieve a babysitter, and hurried out of the aisle. Then she said, "Wait!" Blizzard stopped and looked at her. "Did you like it?"
"Like what?" he asked.
"The movie," she said.
"Oh, yeah," he said.
Arriving home, he knew the kids would be bathed, their teeth brushed, they'd be in clean pajamas and looking at books in the room they still shared. He knew that they would not be asleep. 6 and 4, they were technically old enough to fall asleep themselves, but since their mother had left, they never fell asleep with the babysitter. They always waited for him, for Daddy. He woke up later that night thirsty next to his daughter. She exhaled a soft, high buzz beside him. He touched her forehead as if checking for a fever, a habit he'd never been able to break since she'd suffered a bout of strep at the age of 2. Then, calmed by the coolness of her, he readjusted her blanket and her bear and left the room. It was 2 a.m. He went to the kitchen for water, still dressed in his clothes, the butter and salt still on his tongue. And the next Monday, Blizzard went back to the movies. He sat in the same seat. Hamlet had opened 5 nights ago, and everybody in town was now calling Angela Ophelia. So commanding was her performance on opening weekend, so transfixing was she as she moved across the stage in a white slip of a ragged dress, mud on her fine, delicate calves and leaves in her golden hair. He'd been there. He'd seen it. Angela did not seem to mind the new attention. He supposed actors thrived on it. She responded to the change in name. At the cafe, the diner, the tavern, the shops, he heard her answering to Ophelia. But now, as she walked into the theater again with popcorn, and this time also a jumbo Pepsi, and sat down next to him yet again, Blizzard said, "Hi, Angela." He would not call her Ophelia. "Hey, Blizzard," she said. "Popcorn?" She knew his name. This surprised him. Of course, she would have recognized his face, had seen him many times walk by wearing his tool belt or holding a broom at the theater, but his name? He did not think she'd know that. When the opening shots of the feature presentation lit up the screen, Blizzard saw the same couple he'd seen last week, that same California coast, the same journey to a wedding neither of the characters wanted to attend, the same movie. Angela looked at Blizzard, and then she shrugged, a delightful, invigoratingly careless shrug, followed by a high, seemingly involuntary whoop of laughter, which made her place her fine hand over her mouth. "We've seen this," she whispered and snorted back more laughter. They dug into the popcorn anyway, watched the whole mediocre film a second time. During the funniest parts of the movie, and there were a few, Blizzard hoped he might once again hear that whoop. He was having this thought when Angela reached over and handed him the Pepsi. "You want some?" she said. He took the cup from her, hesitating, and then, feeling the cold sweat of it, suddenly aware of that salted thirst that seemed to creep all the way back from his throat, from a fire in his lungs, Blizzard took a long sip from the straw, the same straw that Angela had been using, and then slowly he handed her the massive cup again. It was the most intimate thing he'd experienced in over 2 years.
And I've always known what to expect and where I should go and what I should get. And they've always shown they don't want to know. Now the picture show's over. I've gotta get home. But I want to wait till the sun peaks up and sit by you on a quiet bench. I won't speak. When the picture shows over, I'll get on home. Send them on their way. Send them on their way. In the morning we'll find me home.
Burns and novelist Dean Bacopoulos. They are here on the radio and on our radio stage with their story log, live music and storytelling performance. We're also talking about the character of small towns. Have you ever lived in a small town? What did you love enough about it to stay or hate enough about it to leave? 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you want to join the show. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to 45 North, and we're talking with singer-songwriter Katie Burns and novelist Dean Bacopoulos today. By the way, Katie's performing tomorrow night at the Mineral Point Opera House with a full band. Mm-hmm. That's 7:30, I think, Katie? Yeah. And details, you'll find details on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. You guys, that was just so terrific. I love that story. And I was thinking, they're sitting there watching a movie. Clearly the movie is a romantic comedy. And I was thinking, well, if this was a movie, this would be, I think, don't they call it a meet-cute?
Yes, and, right.
Right, meet-cute. But except that it's also kind of an anti-meet-cute, you know? So I was thinking, is it hard or complicated to write romance these days?
I hope not. My next novel is all romance. So my next book's a love story. I think that it's actually one of the last things that has to happen in person in this world, right? You can do a lot of stuff virtually, but it's really tough to, you may be able to fall in love online, but you really can't be in love online for very, you know, forever. You do need to be together. So there's just a charge of that interaction that comes when people meet. So I feel it's something that people are interested in kind of exploring, like where how do those things happen? Those are one of the few mysteries left, right?
Now, you've got such a great setting. You've got automatically the small town, and then the stranger comes to town, or in this case, a lot of strangers. There's mm-hmm. a summer theater troupe, right? That's a whole, an iconic part of small, at least in Wisconsin, small towns, the summer theater troupe that comes in.
Certainly. And of course, I spent a lot of time going to shows at American Players Theater in Spring Green, where I try to get to as many shows as I can each season. And I'm always wonder what it's like to be an actor in one of these troupes where you show up and pretend to be someone else, but everyone in town knows who you are. They know you're there as an actor. They don't really know you, though. They know you as a character. And I was intrigued by that, having fallen in love with a couple of actresses from afar, you know. Just bad crushes. I thought I would wonder, like, what would it be like if one of them actually talked to you?
Katie, is that sort of a big part of Mineral Point life, the summer theater people?
In Mineral Point, not as much as when you're in Spring Green. Yeah, it's more a Spring Green thing. But I definitely know a lot of them. They're around, yeah.
And what are the secret things that the people in town think about the summer people who come through?
Well, I think that it adds an excitement, right? It just all of a sudden new faces in a small town are exciting, and it adds an excitement, but it's also they're from different worlds and different places and have different ways of doing things. So there always is a little bit of tension, just like in Grinnell where I teach, there's always a little bit of town and gown tension. You know, people come to do their thing to these remote places, and there's other people who've been there for a long time that aren't attached to that thing. So it's almost two worlds start to exist, but they always overlap, and that's usually late at night.
But I always kind of wonder that, because it's such a Wisconsin experience, is, you know, you go for a drive. Like, if you live in a city in Wisconsin, you go for a drive, and you drive into some pretty small town, and maybe you get out, and there's a way in which it doesn't feel so great to walk through this town like a tourist, you know, like an other. And I always sort of wonder, how do the people in this town see me? Do they think, oh, there's one of them?
It depends on who they are. Some people see you as a wallet, you know. I mean, in a very practical sense, I think most of the towns really like the visitors on the whole, because they provide, you know, that's how they thrive. That's their economy. I think at other times it's a matter of respect. I think if people try to get to know the town, I think the town is pretty open to newcomers. I know Mineral Point is one of the friendliest towns around. I had lived there for almost 4 years, and it was, I knew everybody by the time we left. I knew everyone in the first 6 weeks. I mean, we were on the cover of the local paper 3 days after moving in.
There are also definite seasons in small towns, too, which you point out. I mean, summer, well, I remember driving along the Great River Road. I think it was the kids' spring break, and so we were there in like March or something. And we just thought, we'd read all these articles about, oh, the River Road, these beautiful small towns, it'll be wonderful. So we drive through, and like, everything's closed up. The towns were, you know, the windows were shuttered. Occasionally we'd find somebody just opening up a, you know, store and sweeping things out, and they looked astonished that we wanted ice cream.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're very seasonal. I mean, if you remember, we used to have seasons in Wisconsin. There was this thing called summer that showed up around this time of year. And the seasonal nature of it is partly what makes it so intense. You get 3 months, 4 months of summer where everybody's out, everything is active, the days are long. And then winter is, you know, for artists, I think both Katie and I, living in small towns in winter, you can get pretty down. You can go to some dark places, but that's where you do your best work.
Is that why you call the story Winter Long?
We're going to get to winter in a little bit, and it's going to be bad.
Sounds like a perfect segue. Okay, let's see what happens.
For the listeners in northern Wisconsin who are looking out at snow, we're going to get to winter. So Blizzard, of course, went back to the movies on the next Monday. There was no way he was going to miss it this time. He didn't have any idea what was going on, but he knew he had to be there for it. And this time he bought a box of snow caps on impulse as he walked into the dark theater. And he got into the theater and he saw that Angela was there already. First time that she'd been there before him, or that he noticed her before he sat down. And he thought maybe he should just sit somewhere else, and then after the movie say, I didn't see you there. So he thought maybe she was just being nice to him. Maybe, like a lot of the actresses, she just didn't want to appear uppity or snobbish. But as he stood there in the center aisle, he felt something trembling inside of him, a sudden desire to shout. And just before he shouted, he heard Angela's voice. Oh, good, she said, and waved him over. He ate some of her popcorn again, and then when she offered him the Pepsi, this time he drank from the straw, the same straw, without hesitation. And then he tore the top from the box of snow caps. He dumped a bunch of snow caps into his mouth, straight from the box, and then offered them silently to her. She accepted. She, too, dumped the snow caps into her mouth, straight from the box that he'd purchased, which he, too, had dumped in his own mouth. He made note of this. She handed the box back to him, and then she rested her head on his shoulder, and there they sat, like that, touching. All the way through the end of the movie, they stayed that way through all the credits, through the lighting techs and the sound engineers, the best boys and key grips. They sat there till the lights came on. That night, as Blizzard was about to put the children into their beds, he suggested they take a drive, to look at the moon, the stars, all of that. And they cheered. He drove with them to Dodgeville, down the darkening highway, and they fell asleep in their boosters. And then he drove back towards home, cruising slowly through lead corners, looking for perhaps, why not admit it, a glimpse of Angela walking in the human night, or chatting with the smokers outside the barn. But she was not there. He parked his car near Veterans Field and watched the fireflies glow and dim over the dewy green of the ball diamond. Once more, he drove by the barn, and he saw her there, outside that tavern. She stood alone on a phone, talking under the glow of a street lamp. He slowed down and smiled, and she turned to him and waved, but she didn't smile back, because Angela Zell was crying. Feeling as if he'd witnessed something he never should have witnessed, he drove straight home, carried the children to their beds, then collapsed on the couch with a beer, and then another, and another, and another. He was not admittedly the only man in lead corners, or among the Prairie Players' 600 season ticket holders who fell for a different actress every season. And he was certainly not the only one to notice Ophelia, Angela, that summer. The men that saw Angela's portrayal of Ophelia that summer, perhaps because their wives had dragged them, let's face it, to see this play, would grow wistful for a few days, sometimes weeks afterwards, and they would spend hours just staring out windows, driving slowly down winding roads at dusk, perhaps puddling up while lacing their work boots. How much of their youth had they squandered, they thought. What they wouldn't give to just touch their hand to that high and pleasant cheek.
That's how good Angela was as Ophelia. She made everyone feel a bit ineffectual and confused after seeing Hamlet, a town full of middle-class Hamlets, whelmed by duty and love, a town full of regret suddenly, a town of men who felt they might have saved her from that madness, from her sealed fate, if only. Naturally, many of the women in town hated Angela Zell. Because they could see that her performance, her very presence in the town, inspired all that wistfulness. Ophelia, strolling across the stage on the balls of her bare, muddy feet, singing the nonsense rhymes of a woman unstrung, this sight made their husbands' hearts heavy with regret and longing, and Midwesterners in general tend to be very mistrustful of longing. So theater is difficult for them. Now, there's a part of the story I'll kind of go through quickly because there were two Mondays where Blizzard showed up and she wasn't there. No explanation. One of the Mondays, he ended up sitting next to Mitch Michaels, who ran the local hardware store, who had the loudest laugh in town. It seemed to amplify his own loneliness. And the next Monday, his sister couldn't babysit, and he panicked, and he took the kids to see a movie, hearing it was a cartoon, but it was a French cartoon, a scary French cartoon, and Angela wasn't there either. The kids cried through the whole performance, and as he walked them home, as they sobbed and complained of the nightmares they were sure to have, he began to understand that anything that was happening had stopped happening. Now, one might be tempted to quit now, to give up, but Blizzard attended the movies dutifully, and on that last Monday night in August, a stormy night with harrowing winds and lightning out of the western sky, he went to the movies, and just before the opening credits, Angela came in, breathless, soaked with rain. She sat next to him without a word and shivered. He took off his hooded sweatshirt and offered it to her. The balcony was empty and dark. She looked around the theater and slid off her own soaked shirt and let it drop to the floor with a thwack. Then she took the sweatshirt from his hand and slowly slipped it over her head, down over her exposed body. She grabbed his big arm and cuddled up against it, and they watched the movie, like that. Him sitting stiffly and her holding onto his arm, which felt stronger and more capable than he ever knew his own arm could feel. She was crying, though the movie was not sad. And when it ended, but before the lights came up, she turned and kissed him on the lips, and then left first, wearing that sweatshirt, a plain gray XL he picked up at Farm and Fleet over a decade ago. In the morning, on the doorknob to the maintenance shed, there was a hanger. And on the hanger, his sweatshirt. Now, the trouble with summer theater, there's always a closing night. It comes at the end of September, on a Sunday, and afterwards, there is the closing night party. And each season, on closing night, in the early hours of the morning that follows the final show, the drunken shouts and lovelorn speeches of thespians fill High Street and Jefferson Street and Cincinnati Lane with passionate goodbyes, promises to stay in touch, nonsense shouted at the top of very able lungs, a kind of nonsense only funny to fellow thespians. Each year, Blizzard watches this from a barstool, part of the festivities, but apart from it too. Each year, when the last actors finally stagger off back to their apartments, the bar shuts down, and the air suddenly goes flat and brittle, as if it's crafted from antique glass, and Blizzard could shatter it with one awkward bump. Here Blizzard sat once again that year, feeling the melancholy of autumn as a deep ache. He had not seen Angela at the cast party. Surely she'd come, he thought, but for some time he waited and watched for her and finally retreated to a stool at the bar, and drank four more pints. By last call, he was fairly drunk, but the kids were spending the night with his sister, and so he thought he might sit there on the bench all night until dawn, so he could watch the actors and actresses, still bleary, entering minivans and shuttle buses that would whisk them off to the airport, and then to Chicago or Seattle or New York. By noon, they'd all be gone, off to their winter lives and winter work, leaving Lead Corners behind, alone in its winter skin. Gone with the actors, too, would be the summer people, the organic farmers, the cottage dwellers, the free-spending weekenders, and semi-retired baby boomers, all gone to earn money during the lonely months of this year. He was pondering all this from his High Street perch, staring at the abundant and feckless stars when Angela appeared, a vision. She stood above him, and he sat on the bench, She blocked his view. "What?" he said. "No popcorn?" She whooped with laughter. And then she leaned over and kissed him for a long time. He could taste the whiskey on her mouth, knew she was drunk, could feel her fall into his body unsteadily. Afterwards, because he was born in Lead Corners and knew how the town worked, he opened his eyes and looked around. But it seemed as if nobody had seen him kissing her. If they had, he knew he'd be laughed at mercilessly. For locals, nothing is funnier than seeing a commoner fall for the royalty of the theater. But only one thing is stronger than shame, and that thing is need. They held hands, walked the 3 blocks to Ophelia's apartment in silence. On her front porch, she said, "I'm engaged." He nodded. "I see." "Unhappily engaged," she said, "but you should know it." "It won't get less unhappy," he said. "You can trust me." "You mean if we do this?" she asked. "No, in general, if you're unhappy now. Do you care? Or will you come up?" "I don't care," he said. At some point that night, she looked at him while they were together and said, "I am less happy right now. I'm less unhappy than I ever was." "Me too," Blizzard said. "I too am less unhappy." In the morning, when he woke, alone in her abandoned apartment, on the nightstand there was an I Love New York t-shirt, and on it a note that said, "If you're ever in Manhattan," and her phone number.
No, it's not all balloons. Can't pretend that it's true. I know you're not okay. All the pills that you take in me, oh. Scrubbing his dirt off the door. You hate when he's gone, and you hate when he's home. And you curse that day, 'cause you should have known. And we all know it's sad. But what if happiness was a decision? Got to make up your mind to me.
Songwriter Katie Burns and novelist Dean Bacopoulos. They're here on our radio stage with their story log live. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and you are listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. And you're listening to 45 North. I'm Anne Strainchamps. We're here with songwriters and singer Katie Burns. By the way, she's performing in Mineral Point tomorrow night at the Mineral Point Opera House with band. And novelist Dean Bacopoulos, his last novel is just out in paperback, My American Unhappiness, actually set in Madison, Wisconsin. So fun to, even more fun for those of us who live here to read. So I want to ask you guys quickly, because I want to leave enough time to hear the end of the story. I have to know what happens. But I'm curious about writing and sense of place, because, you know, you guys are traveling around doing these stories that are really set in Wisconsin and so evocative, so redolent of Wisconsin. Dean, what is writing, why does it matter to you to write with a strong sense of place?
I just feel like there's no way that any human being can say that their environment doesn't affect them and who they see on a daily basis and what they see out their windows. What landscape they see when they're walking is just so important to the emotional stakes that they kind of are wrestling with. And so, you know, one of the things I like to do is not only write about places I've lived, but go to places for a few days and start writing about them. to try to see what I observe as an outsider. And I think writers and songwriters are always kind of outsiders. We're in a place, but because the act of talking about that place suddenly puts us in the realm of notice or observer, and suddenly you're apart from everything and part of it at the same time.
Katie, do you think of your music as having a sense of place?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking, because when Dean, we were talking about this story, but I hadn't read his story, nor had he heard my song. We were doing it at the same time, but we came up with the same imagery, you know, just from having this kind of idea of what we were writing about. So I think the place, the images, you know, they're strong there with how they affect the song, I guess. So.
I always come back to, there's a quotation from, I think it's from Wallace Stegner. He says something or other, you'll know it, Dean. He says something or other like, no place is a place until it's had that quality of attention paid to it that we call poetry. And he didn't just mean words. He meant songs.
Yeah.
And he specifically in that quote uses that fiction. He says fiction serve as well as facts, which I think storytelling a lot gives you a kind of a shelter from having to, you know, be on script and to really tell things as they happen, because you're free from the burden of getting it perfectly right in terms of facts. And also you can kind of interpret what goes on in those private places that nobody really knows. I mean, that's where a fiction writer, their great power is imagining the most private of moments.
But I think that quotation, he's also suggesting that it's important that we not just live on the surface of the places where we live, that we do our best to kind of get to know them at a deeper level. Is that what you're doing with your work?
I think so. I mean, the new thing I'm working on is set in Grinnell, and I wrote it partly because I wanted to understand this new place I was living. I wanted to really try to imagine it wholly, because you feel more grounded. You feel more connected to a place.
Mm. Do you think something's changing in American culture? It seemed to me for a long time we had this sort of dichotomy where local meant small town and inferior, and big city or national was better. And I kind of wonder if that's changing, if the new, I don't know, sort of hyper-local movement or whatever is, if we're beginning to revalue local.
Well, I think the world is so chaotic, and there's so little you can control, but you can sort of control how your neighborhood evolves, or how your small town evolves, or how your building evolves in a large city. And you try to get it to evolve in a way that shares and reflects your values, is inclusive to other points of view, but also is the kind of place you want to spend time. When you watch the news, you realize you can't control. The global things are just horrifying on a perpetual basis. So there's great comfort in localness, in deciding that you're part of a community, whether it's urban or rural or somewhere in between that, and that you're going to try to make that place the kind of reflection of the values you want the larger world to have.
Mm. Well, maybe it's time to catch up.
Sure.
We have to know what happens to Blizzard and Angela.
Well, winter comes and she's gone. And in general, the winters in Lead Corner are not easy. They're never easy in Wisconsin, particularly in the towns that live and die by the tourists of summer and fall. And all winter, the residents of Lead Corners, though they won't admit it, miss the presence of the actors and the theater-goers and the taverns and shops. They miss the way they order their eggs poached with dry rye toast and no potatoes, no meat. I mean, who does that? No potatoes, no meat? They missed how they asked for pale ales in the tavern, in skinny cappuccinos at the coffee shop, with extra shots and low foam. What does that mean? They missed hearing the actors talk to one another in breathy, playful tones, words like pathos and mercurial and Chekhovian tossed flippantly into the air, beautiful, weighty throwaways. In January, Blizzard's sister, sensing his depression as he stared at the washed-out gray hills that rose from an icy, painful river, urged him to take a vacation, solo. That word, alone time, resurfaced, but all Blizzard could picture was a vision of himself lying on a bed in a Super 8 near Peshtigo, eating Doritos from the vending machine, watching Storage Wars on cable. But one night, 5 Coors Lights into the evening, Blizzard went to the computer in the den and charged a plane ticket and hotel package he found on Travelocity, moving swiftly before he could change his mind. Now, there are men who say they're going to New York and mean it. These men have been there many times before, for a show, an exhibit, for work, for a conference or meeting or the opening of a new gallery. and hopping on a plane for a weekend in Manhattan is of no consequence to them. But Lizard wasn't one of those men. In fact, he'd only been out of Wisconsin four times in his life. Once, he went to the National Mississippi River Museum in Dubuque. Another time, he attended an old high school friend's wedding in the north suburbs of Chicago, and in that particular way of stoic Midwesterners, drove down for the wedding and drove home after cake. He'd gone fishing at a cabin on Perch Lake in the UP of Michigan before, but that really should be Wisconsin. And then he'd gone to college in Duluth for a year, a bad year, end of travels. To him, venturing south of Chicago seemed to be a strange exercise in flatness and humidity, and heading east of the Great Lakes for any reason was asking for trouble and traffic. He'd also never been on an airplane before, had never done the awkward dressing and undressing required at the security checkpoint. He'd never eaten a Cinnabon before, sitting in the bright concourse watching streams of busy Americans bolting past, all of them talking on something. He had never felt the upward lift of his abdomen that occurred as the plane zipped off the runway and up into the air. He had never made small talk with a seatmate before, in this case an Avon lady named Clarice. "What brings you to the Big Apple?" Clarice said, her opening line to a conversation Blizzard did not know how to avoid. He was new to air travel, and he did not know to reply only in grunts, did not know that one answer of any kind of cordiality with this kind of person would lead to a two-hour-long conversation. And so he answered. He answered without thinking, "I'm going to visit someone," and then added perplexingly, "my fiancé." "Oh, fabulous," Clarice said. "Yes, she's an actress there in New York City." "Broadway?" Clarice asked. "Mm-hmm," he said. "Yes, Broadway." "Really? What show?" "Several, actually. Bit parts." He was worried he'd be outed, revealed as a man in front of all those passengers with no legitimate and respectable business in New York. Clarice rummaged in a duffel bag under her seat. She sighed and humped, and Blizzard could smell the faint whiff of sweat. He imagined she would say to him, "But she's already engaged, isn't she?" But she did not. Instead, sitting up, she handed him a small pink bag, festooned with curly white ribbons. "Perfume and lotion," she said, "for your bride-to-be." "Thanks," Blizzard said. The tiny bottles and tubes looked ridiculous in his large, battered hands. "When's the wedding?" Clarice said. He was intoxicated by the idea of being in a place where he knew nobody, where he knew his lies could grow as big and ambitious as he wanted them to. "August 15th, Blizzard blurted out. "Oh, fabulous," Clarice said. And then Blizzard watched her pull a pill from her purse, swallow it without water, and then, within 10 minutes, fall into a deep sleep, a soft snoring sleep. He thought he heard her murmur the word a few times. "Fabulous. Fabulous." Blizzard wished for one of those pills. He wanted a drink, but the flight attendant was moving the drink cart, it seemed to him, with exaggerated delay, as if she was deliberately withholding the alcohol from him. He looked around the plane, craning his neck behind him, and then peering out ahead of himself. He made eye contact with several passengers, and they swiftly averted their gaze. Maybe they knew he was a fraud. The plane bumped once, then twice, and the captain came over the intercom to announce that they had successfully reached cruising altitude. Seatbelts were optional. They were free to move. He put down his seat tray and spread the Avon products out in front of him. Then he swiftly put them away, embarrassed when a suited man across the aisle began to look at him curiously. The plane lurched forward. The captain asked the standing passengers to sit. There was some unexpected turbulence. It wasn't going to last, the captain assured them, but for now, you better sit. Better buckle your seatbelts. It was the third day of April by then. And all around Blizzard, people were calm. The Avon lady snored away. But Blizzard understood that he, that all of them, were risking their lives. All of these people he had never seen before in his life, and probably would never see again. This gaggle of strangers in the struggling yellow light of mid-afternoon, of early spring, all of them allowed themselves to be held aloft, up in the air, driven by the silliest of whims. ¶¶
Would you recommend I grab a taxi and fly to you? How safe are the city streets for someone brand new? 'Cause all winter long I thought of nothing but you. The street lights came on and all around me the snow flew. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. If there were no words, there was no space. All this winter long, I'd be the bridge, I'd be the taxi, I'd be the city sound. Whoa. Take the city stairs to the subway underground. Take an elevator ride to the sky and back down. 'Cause all winter long I thought of nothing but you. Tow truck stuck, everybody pushing through. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. If there were no needs, there was no dreams. All this winter long, I'd be the vendor, I'd be the river, a barricade undone.
And oh my goodness, I can't stand it. We're going to have to leave it there with him suspended literally in midair.
We're writing a sequel. We'll come to your town and tell it.
Okay. That's a plan. Katie Burns and Dean Bacopoulos with their story log, the first one. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Adam.
Katie's a singer-songwriter from Mineral Point, Wisconsin. She's got a new CD out called You'll Find Your Way. She's also performing tomorrow night at the Mineral Point Opera House with a full band, and you'll find details on our website, 45 North on WPR. Dean is an award-winning novelist who used to live in Wisconsin before ditching us to teach creative writing in Iowa. He's written two critically acclaimed novels, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon and My American Unhappiness. And this show happened to the hard work of a lot of talented people behind the scenes. Thanks to producer Marika Sival, to Rhonda Fanning, Brittany True, Dave Potras, Tom Blaine, Joe Hartke, and a whole lot more. I'm Ann Strainchamps. See you again next Friday here on 45 North from Wisconsin Public Radio.
When the picture shows over, I'll get on.